So, good evening. Tonight's topic from one of it's an occasional series here on women and tonight it's women and tefillah, and we're going to talk about minyan and being a shliach tzibur or a chazan. So, we're going to start with a little introduction. So for your consideration, we have two things. And we're going to talk a lot about halakha tonight, so I just want to do a quick overview of what I mean by that. So, in America, we have rights, right? We have the right to free speech, and the right to own a gun, and the right to assemble, and...
Steve, don't close it all the way to
the case. That is our freedom. But in Judaism, we have the opposite. We have responsibilities, which leads to a very different legal system when you think about it, because in the American system, we are prevented from doing bad, right? I can't come onto the street and attack you because you have a right to your own person. But in Judaism, you have a responsibility, let's say, to take care of the poor or to give tzedakah. So this is the language of Judaism, and it's a language of obligation. That's the word you're going to hear a lot tonight. And the Hebrew for the word obligation is chiyuv. So when it comes to things in Judaism, we have the two terms chayav, means you are obligated, and patur, which means you are free of obligation. And really, when it comes down to that, halakha is all about what is the obligation? In other words, what is the commandment? And then who, how, when, where do we discharge that obligation? And notice there's no why in that. We don't ever really question why we do it. We just know that's what we have to do. So that's the first consideration. And it's a different mindset. So to get to the first source in Bava Kamma, Tractate of the Talmud, Rabbi Hanina stated, greater is the one who is commanded and does than one who is not commanded and does. So this involves getting your head around it a little, because it's counterintuitive. So think of it this way. In Judaism, you get more points for doing what you should than you do if you don't have to do it.
You don't get bonus points for doing extra.
Well, you do get bonus points, but it's more important to do what you're obligated to do than do, which is right the opposite of the way we kind of think of as an American free society. If I help you and I don't have to, that's above and beyond what the law says. But you see, we're not driven there by an obligation. Here, the thing is, you have this obligation, you must discharge it, you must fulfill it. So does that make it any clearer, Stu?
A little bit.
Right? What it's saying is it's more praiseworthy to do what you have to do than to arbitrarily do something else.
Yeah, but I would think it's more praiseworthy to take on additional obligations.
That's what he's saying. That's why he said it's counterintuitive.
But the point is that if you don't have to do something, okay, but you take on an additional obligation, shouldn't that be more praiseworthy?
So, not to split hairs, but when you say take on another obligation, that in a sense makes it an obligation. It's really more of an intent thing, right? If you do something because you have to do it, not because you want to do it. And there's more points for doing it because you have to do it.
Right. But if you want to do it and you start to do it, I mean, isn't that more, shouldn't that be more?
It's not more, it's less. It's still praiseworthy, but it's not as praiseworthy.
See, that's where it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, how about this? If Steve doesn't eat shellfish because he's allergic to it, that he's doing the right thing. But if Steve is not allergic to shellfish, and so he would want to eat it, it's more praiseworthy that he's not eating it because of an obligation, because of a mitzvah, than because if he ate it, he'd break out in a rash. So that's So it's more praiseworthy to do something you're supposed to do than if you just would have done it and it kind of didn't matter.
Well, but then does that mean that Steve doesn't eat shrimp because he can't or because he won't? He's not allowed.
Because like, I'm thinking like the Book of Ruth, right? How Ruth like took on extra obligations, and we thought that was like extraordinary, right? So that's why I'm like kind of with Stu on this one, which is I'm having a hard time that if somebody is not obligated but makes that extra commitment, that's.
I think kind of saying that they don't want you to pick and choose. In other words, once you say you do something that you don't have to do it, that maybe that you're telling yourself, I can pick and choose. But, we have 613 commandments. Some of them are like, why in the world would you do that? But that's a commandment, so you do it. So I think it's trying to take, you from making a decision. You do it because God told you to do it, the Torah told you to do it.
And I'll apologize if I'm off base with, how would Maimonides' levels of charity fall into this?
I don't know. I'd have to think about it.
But that's how you're doing the charity.
But I like what Stan said. That it's more of a mindset that these are the things you have to do rather than walk around and think these are the things you'd like to do. It's probably more directed, right? Because what you may think is a good thing to do, I may not think is a good thing to do, and vice versa.
Right. But there are of the 630.
Here's another example. So let's morning minion.
Right.
If you're there every morning because you really love getting up in the morning and davening, and everybody's left, but there are people that truly,
there are people that really wake up happily for that.
That's one person that's there versus the other person that's there because I hate getting up in the morning, but I have to do this every morning. So which took greater effort?
I have another one. What if you're called because you need to make minion and you go, but you're called and you don't go?
Well, you're still obligated.
No, but I remember.
But my point is that it's doing something because you're doing it for the joy of doing it.
Yeah, but
it's great and it's
right.
Wonderful.
The rabbis don't trust the human heart.
But it's a much greater effort and therefore more worthy of praise if you really didn't want to get out of bed, but you do it every morning anyway.
I don't know if that's a great example because technically you're obligated either way.
Let's say
in an Orthodox world where women are not obligated.
Right.
But the rabbi told me that, and he goes almost every morning to the morning minion, and he said sometimes he doesn't, and he's not obligated by his contract to go. He says, sometimes, he thinks, well, maybe I'll skip a minion, but they might not have a minion. So that's kind of,
But that, there you run into a problem, because then if you're going, not for yourself, but because you want to let other people fulfill their obligation, I would say it's not on the same level as you going to fulfill your own obligation.
Right, you're right.
We can disagree with the rabbi, right? We do all the time.
Yeah, right.
This is where they're coming from when they make that statement.
And I would also make the sociological observation to what Michelle said, which is why people are always so disconcerted at Orthodox shuls. They're praying so fast. And, it's all in Hebrew and that, because they have the obligation and they want to get rid of it. And that's it. They're not sitting there.
They want to get rid of it is the part I have.
They want to discharge it.
Well, we do this.
Right. And they're not sitting there thinking about, am I being fulfilled and is the melody nice?
No.
They got to get it done.
They got to say the Amidah, they got to say the Shema, they got to get out.
Okay, so we're going to move along. There's still the introduction.
I'll revisit this another time.
We'll agree to disagree.
Okay.
Well, we got through the first one.
We're not even finished with it yet. So the second part of the introduction, which is really a review, is to talk about women in particular. So we had a whole session on this, that women are historically and halakhically exempt from positive time-bound commandments. Even though there are exceptions in all directions. So there are positive non-time-bound commandments that women are exempt from. There are positive commandments that they are. So it goes both ways. And Stanley brought up the 613 mitzvot. So it turns out that of the 613, there are 60 positive commandments that are incumbent on us today, and women are exempt from 14 of them. 8 of them being positive time-bound commandments, and 6 of them not being time-bound commandments. And we spent a long time talking about why this is. You know, traditional wisdom is always women are more obligated at the home, so therefore they can't plan their lives out the way they will. And that's a little problematic, but that's kind of where we start off with. Okay, so having said all that, we're now ready to get into the first Mishnah, which comes from Brachot, appropriately, which is the tractate of the Talmud that discusses prayer. So we have a very famous Mishnah. Women, slaves, and minors are exempt from reciting the Shema and Tefillin, but are subject to the obligations of Tefillah, Mezuzah, and Grace After Meals, which, of course, is Birkat Hamazon. So let's take that apart now. So the typical explanation for this Mishnah is that women, children, and slaves are exempt from time-bound positive commandments, as well as they are obligated for non-time-bound positive commandments, plus, of course, all the negative commandments. So if we go through the list, Shema is a positive time-bound commandment. Tefillin is considered a positive time-bound commandment because you can't put tefillin on at night, you can only put them on during the day, so now we already get into a little bit of a gray area about what that means, time-bound. So that's why they're exempted. Now we go to the other three, right? Mezuzah is a positive commandment, but it is not time-bound. Ditto Birkat Hamazon is a positive commandment, but it is not time-bound.
But it is time-bound.
It's bound to your meal.
Yeah. It's bound to your meal, but it's not bound to time of day. You could have your main meal at midnight.
Yeah, but then you have to say it before you stand up from the table.
Yes, but you could eat any time you want. That's the whole point.
Okay. Presumably you could eat when you have time, you know, 5 minutes to say your prayer. So.
Yeah. Now we get to tefillah, right? So it seems like it would be a positive time-bound commandment. Okay. So here are two explanations for that. So although each tefillah is time-bound, and we're going to say for the moment tefillah is amidah, but that's not necessarily clear either. Shemona Esrei, the 18 blessings. Although it is time-bound, tefillah is time-bound, there's no specific time of the day when one could not recite the Amidah. When the time for reciting the morning Amidah is over, you can immediately say the Mincha Amidah. When Mincha ends, you can immediately say the Mariv Amidah. So, although each tefillah has its own set time, overall the mitzvah is not considered to be time-bound.
I thought there were time, but like, you couldn't say Mincha before certain time.
Right, but he's saying yes. because there's an Amida for each service.
But how is that affect
the
tefillin?
When it gets too late to say the morning one, you can just say the afternoon one.
Or just think of it this way. You have an obligation to say
one of them, not
tefillah in the morning, but you could do it at 6 a.m. or you could do it at 10 a.m. So in that sense, it's not fixed.
But you could do it later than, let's say, 11 a.m. or whatever.
There's definitely... Again, there's a time bounds for prayer, but not for within, not a specific time.
I think
time.
The trick here is to say an Amidah, not all of the Amidahs.
Yeah, because the rules for saying the morning Amidah is the same as for putting on tefillin.
Right, so it's an, yes. It's because there's multiple of them in the day, it's an Amidah.
Okay, but careful, tefillin and Amidah are separate mitzvahs.
No, I understand, but they're saying here that tefillin is time bound, but... saying the Amidah is not.
Because you have multiple opportunities during the day.
Let's say an Amidah rather than the Amidah. Say an Amidah, one of them.
So, this is an explanation. It is not the explanation.
Right. No, I know.
So, there is a second explanation here. Saying, okay, let's say the mitzvah is time-bound. Women and children and slaves are still obligated. Why? And now we get into what is a tefillah, Because tefillah might mean we are all obligated to make requests of God and ask for mercy from God. That is incumbent upon all human beings. So if you say tefillah is about asking for your needs and praising God for your needs that have been fulfilled, then women, children, and slaves have the same needs as free adult men. So therefore, everybody is obligated in saying this. So these are two explanations for this particular Mishnah. But of course, we'll see as it changes. Oh, and I just want to put a note here that's out of order. One of the problems with the positive time-bound commandment theory is that it applies to all adult women, but if the reasoning is about their time is not set, then how would that, it still applies to widows, and it still applies to women who no longer have children or couldn't, who are single or couldn't bear children. So that kind of makes a difficulty with the whole positive time-bound commandment thing in the first place. Okay. Now we're going to go on, and this is a first, Steve. We're going to do some philology.
Ooh.
Yes, very exciting. So we're going to look at the text of the Talmud, the Gemara, that comments on this Mishnah. And it turns out that there are four complete manuscripts in existence of the tractate Brachot. Three of them are different. One is a copy of the fourth. And this is the fun philological part. They're not all the same. And I have for you the three different manuscripts here that respond to this Mishnah. So, the first one says, reciting Shema and Tefillin, which are positive time-bound commandments, and for all positive time-bound commandments, women are exempt. So, continuing, Tefillah, Mezuzah, and Grace After Meals are positive commandments not bound by time, and all positive commandments not bound by time, women are obligated. So, summarize in a sentence, tefillah is not a positive time-bound commandment, therefore women are obligated. Everyone got that?
Yeah, so I'm actually surprised. I always thought this whole positive time-bound thing was a theory. This is actually Steve's.
No, it's literally the language of the Gemara.
Yeah, I never realized it was in the text.
Oh, okay.
I thought this was just
it was like a custom or something.
No, that was what the comments, you know, what the people who studied this stuff had figured out. I never realized it was actually in the text.
Okay, manuscript two. What might you say? Now this means maybe you're going to follow this line of reasoning. Since the text says, evening, morning, and afternoon will I pour out my heart and moan, it is like a positive time-bound commandment. So you might come and argue from this verse in Psalms that prayer is a positive time-bound commandment. Therefore, women would be exempted. So the Mishnah comes to teach you that women are obligated. So what they're saying here is you might think the opposite, but the Mishnah is telling you that women are obligated to say tefillah.
Is that because there's flexibility in morning, day, and evening? Or?
They don't. No. The reasoning here is that prayer is pour out my heart and moan, it means pray. And the verse says, evening, morning, and afternoon, I will pray. Right. So you would say, based on that, like we just talked about tefillin, right, it is a positive time-bound commandment, therefore women are not obligated. So the Mishnah comes specifically to contradict that idea, to say, no, you got it wrong. They're telling you whatever it is, it's an obligation. And finally, we have manuscript three, but are obligated in tefillah, that's quoting from the Mishnah, because it is a supplication for divine mercy. So they're taking a whole different tack here. They're not talking about the time anymore. They're talking about the content. Tefillah is obligatory because we're praying for mercy, and it has to do with the content. And, of course, anything that comes in the Gemara is rabbinic. So it's saying that this is a rabbinic obligation. Okay.
So they're all different, but they all say the same thing. They come to the same conclusion.
No, the first one said women are exempt.
Yes, I think you're right about that.
No, women are obligated.
No.
No, women are exempt.
No, they're all, no, it says they're obligated.
The second part about it, the one says they're obligated.
Okay, yes.
You're correct. All three things say women are obligated.
Sorry.
So there seems to be a general consensus that women are obligated in tefillah. But now if we come back to the question of what does tefillah mean? Is it prayer? Right, that's modern Hebrew. Tefillah means prayer. In the Talmud, generally, tefillah means amidah. That's what it's called. So we'll now go to the Mishneh Torah, which is Maimonides, which is that around the year 1100. And this is a really nice, as he is very clear, and he's going to walk you through the whole steps now of a summary of prayer, where it comes from and what's the obligation. So he says it is a positive Torah commandment to pray every day. And how do we learn? And this is not clear, by the way, that we do have a Torah obligation to pray every day. So he derives it from this text in Exodus that says you will serve God your Lord. And tradition teaches us that this service, literally the word avodah there, means prayer. Because it says in Deuteronomy, you serve him with your heart. So they're making a jump here, right? service goes to heart. And the sages say, service of the heart, that's prayer. However, the number of prayers is not prescribed in the Torah, nor does it prescribe a specific formula for prayer. Also, according to Torah, there is no fixed time for prayer, which is kind of startling to us today because it doesn't seem that way, because we know there are fixed times for prayer. So it's an interesting... So theoretically, at this point, according to Maimonides, you wake up every day and say, thank you, God, for my life, and you fulfilled your obligation for prayer. Number two, therefore, women and slaves are obligated to pray. Notice he leaves out kids. I don't know why. Since it is not a time-oriented commandment. It is not a PTBC, as we've been saying. And now we get into some history. This was the ongoing practice from Moshe Rabbeinu until Ezra. So he's now arguing from tradition that this has always been the case. Women have always been obligated to pray, and they prayed. Now comes along Ezra. And this is interesting to read in the year 2019 because they're talking now about the time of Ezra, so it's like 450 BCE. When someone would pray, he would be limited in his ability to request his needs or praise the Holy One, blessed be he, in Hebrew. Because languages were mixed in with it. In other words, like today, not everyone knew Hebrew in those days. They all spoke Aramaic. When Ezra and his court saw this, they established 18 blessings in sequence. So that's the Amidah, that's the Shemona Esrei, and what he's saying here, which is really interesting, is that this was invented by Ezra to help people pray. It's kind of a prayer for dummies version. And people didn't have to make... Right, in Christianity you have a big thing with spontaneous prayer. Jews don't believe in that. Jews believe in having fixed texts to pray for. And by the way, Ezra... is famous in all these things, right? Because there's a scholarly theory that when the people came back from Babylonia, they had, the book of Ezra says, they didn't know what to do and they were renovating the palace and they found a book of Deuteronomy. It's thought to be the book of Deuteronomy. Some people think it's the Torah. And people didn't know what the Torah was. And Ezra had a big assembly and he read the Torah and the people wept. And that's when they started reading the Torah three times a week. And so Ezra has a standing on level of Moses. Moses brought the Torah to the Jewish people, and in a sense, Ezra reintroduced it to the Jewish people.
All right, so this is Maimonides crediting Ezra with putting together the Amidah.
Yes.
But aren't there Talmudic passages that start to define the Amidah?
Yes, but the Talmud comes...
After Ezra.
Way after
Ezra, okay. Okay.
So they're just
okay,
checking the received wisdom.
Got it, okay.
Okay. So now we have Ezra and his court. Ezra, I don't know why it says his court. Ezra established tefillah. Now remember, there's no fixed time, no number of times, blah, blah, blah. So he did that too. They decreed the number of prayers to correspond to the number of sacrifices, which means twice a day. Morning, afternoon. Those are at least the rabbinically, if not the biblically mandated times of prayer. And they also instituted a prayer to be recited at night. So this is also another interesting fact. Having evening prayers, in effect, is elective. You can choose to have them or not, and typically the reason was it's dangerous to be out late at night.
But would this be the Amida or the Shema, the nighttime Shema?
This number five, that would be the Amida. Yeah,
that would be by the Maariv service.
Okay, because all right.
Right.
I guess because I'm not reading.
My recollection is that the Shema was moved into the Maariv.
Because you're saying they instituted a prayer to be recited at night.
He's talking about six, not five.
I'm talking about six.
Yeah.
So that prayer means the same one as in five, which means the Amida.
Okay.
Five is Shacharit Mincha, and six is Maariv.
Right.
My recollection, I may have this wrong, but my recollection is they moved the evening Shema into Maariv because people weren't doing it at bedtime. Just like the Birchot HaShachar was moved into Shacharit because it's supposed
just
to be.
In case.
No, you were supposed to do it when you got up.
When you first wake up, before you do anything.
Right, you were supposed to do all that. HaShachar. Right.
Yeah.
And I think the evening Shema, I think the Shema and Maariv is the same thing.
So.
Well, let's be careful. Shema is a different mitzvah than tefillah. And I'm talking in terms of prayer in general.
Correct.
Right? So we have a Torah obligation to say the Shema when you lie down and when you rise up, meaning morning and evening.
Right.
And that's independent. My guess is that what you said, that when they developed, let's say, the Shacharit service, they threw the Shema in.
All right. Oh, they instituted it. Okay, yeah.
But this is when they instituted the prayer service, Shacharit.
The Amida three times a day.
Right? I guess presumably you would have said, because you need a minyan to say the Amidah, but you don't need a minyan to say Shema. You have to say Shema twice a day.
Right.
Okay.
You only need a minyan to say Kedusha. You could say
the rest of the Amidah.
The rest of the Amidah without a minyan.
Yes, you do. But so we'll get to that actually. Anyway, so this is Maimonides giving you. I always like to know, like, where did this come from? And this is basically where we get our modern day prayer. Now, I have, after that, I want to show three Rishonim. These are the first commentators on the Talmud. Again, discussing this in general. So the Mishneh Torah, which we just read from Maimonides, this is in a different place. Women, slaves, and children are obligated to pray. Anyone exempt from Kriyat Shema, that is reciting the Shema, is also exempt from the Amidah. And that he uses that word there. So,
but who is that referring to? Because nobody is exempt from the Shema.
Yes, some people are exempt at certain times. So a man who's going to be married is exempt from saying the Shema on his wedding night. A mourner who has not yet buried his dead is exempt from Shema. And I don't know, I'm sure there's many other things. So that's Maimonides. Next we have the Shulchan Aruch, which is Rabbi Yosef Karo. It's around late 1400s CE. Women and slaves, even though they are exempt from reciting Shema, are obligated in prayer because this is not a positive time-bound mitzvah. So it's a little different reasoning here, but again, obligation. And finally, we have Rashi, who's in the year 1000, and he's commenting on the Gemara. And he's back to the content thing. Tefillah is a supplication for divine mercy, and it is rabbinic, not Torah. And they also enacted it for women and for the education of children. So the children crept back in here. So however you look at this, at this point you can conclude that women are obligated to say tefillah three times a day. That's where we are with the sources. Now we have three in a sense, proofs that women were praying from the sources. So the first is from the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. Rabbi Aha, in the name of Rabbi Tanhuma, son of Rabbi Chia, in the name of Rabbi Simla. A city in which everyone is a Kohen, they raise their hands. And who responds Amen? Women and children. So this is the, we don't do this here. Highland Park, they do it. And in Israel, they do this every day. The Kohanim get up before the congregation. They do the Spock thing, which Spock got it from them. And they make the blessing. And note, again, the Talmud is telling you that women were there saying Amen. So they must have been part of the prayer service. Another Yerushalmi, Rabbi Yossi, the son of Rabbi Bun, said, a suspicious husband, that's the tractate Sota about the wife who's suspected of adultery, who said, the husband says to the wife, do not enter the synagogue. Even if he said that, she may enter with him. Once again, what's the point here? Women were going to the synagogue to pray.
So this, he couldn't keep her out of the synagogue.
Well, he had no control over his wife, which is something that we understand.
Well, we like to pretend.
And on the same topic, in the Babylonian Talmud, in the same tractate of Sota, the significance of receiving divine reward, here you go, can be learned from a widow. There was a certain widow in a neighborhood where there was a synagogue, but despite this, she went down the block and prayed in Rabbi Yochanan's synagogue. And he said to her, my daughter, is there not a synagogue in your neighborhood? And she said, my teacher, don't I retain a reward for all the steps I take while walking to pray in the distant study hall? So she was a devotee, an acolyte of Rabbi Yochanan, and wanted to go pray in his synagogue. And here's a case where she's getting a reward for going the extra way.
Well,
is she
asked if she
is. Yeah.
Well, she is because she was getting a lot of exercise, so she probably was healthier and lived longer because of it. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the same reward. It could be a different reward.
So, and this is an area where there are many, many medieval sources, Talmudic sources, Ashkenazic sources, early modern period in like 18th century Jerusalem of women who pray. So women have prayed throughout history. So let's summarize this whole section. Right? Halakha obligates men to daven three times every day. Shacharit, Mincha, Maariv. The degree to which women are obligated to daven is a subject debated by the early halakhic authorities. There are some authorities who exempt women from davening altogether, as long as they make that simple, like, thank God for life prayer in the morning. Most authorities maintain that women are obligated to pray twice a day, Shachri and Mincha, just like men, and there is a minority of poskim that say women are obligated three times a day. And nowadays, so that's kind of where we are. Nowadays, we are witnessing a remarkable turnabout with regard to women in prayer, and many women who are more educated, who have more time, are now assuming the obligation of prayer in themselves. So that's where we stand, as usual when it comes to women's thing. There's kind of no one-sentence answer about this. Okay, that's the filah. Now we move on to minyan, which is always a fun topic. Okay, so in Megillah, in the tractate Megillah, they talk about where you need 10 people. And here we go. Now, these are the situations in which you can't do these things unless you have 10 men, we'll say for the moment. They do not recite the Shema responsively. So, in the time of the Mishnah, they didn't say the Shema the way we say the Shema. The way they did it is the leader would stand up and say the first part of the verse, and the people would respond with the second part of the verse. That practice changed sometime during the Talmudic period, and then they started doing it the way we do it today. Excuse me. So that was saying the Shema. And they do not pass before the ark. So passing before the ark means repetition of the Shemona Esrei. They do not lift up their hands. So that is the Kohanim doing the blessing. They do not read Torah, that we understand. They do not conclude with a Haftorah. And the reason is because if they did a Haftorah, then people would assume it's okay to read the Torah, which it's not. So therefore, that's like a fence. They cut that out. They do not make stops at funeral processions. So this is another ancient practice we don't do, but when they would carry the body to the cemetery, they would stop at various points and recite eulogies. And you needed a minion to do that. They would do this 7 times. It's probably a good thing we don't do that. And they do not...
Barclay would be a mess.
And they do not say blessings for the mourners or the comfort of mourners. So again, in those days, the blessing for mourners was recited in a public square. And comforting mourners, like today, is when you return from the cemetery. So these are all the things, or the blessings of bridegrooms. And they do not mention God's name in the invitation, except in the presence of 10. Now, that's the Baruch Hu. Okay. So what do all these things have in common that they require a minyan? And the answer to that is they are put in the general category of Dvarim Sheh B'Kedusha, holy things to translate, H-O-L-Y things, which generally goes under the rubric of saying God's name, Hashem. And these are things that require sanctity. Now, there is no prohibition for women doing these things anywhere in the Talmud or anywhere in Maimonides. And the argument was, well, I'm actually a little bit ahead of myself. We'll see in the next verse. The verse says, B'nei Yisrael, right? We all know this phrase, the children of Israel. This is going to interest some of you. So some tried to make, and so who counts as B'nei Israel? We would say everybody. Some people tried to argue in those days that B'nai was the male form of the verse. So it means sons of Israel, not children of Israel. But there is a general principle, it's very resonant today, that the Torah was given in male language. Just like we would say in today's world, he does not necessarily mean a male, it's a pronoun for third person, singular, like you. The Torah works in that whole function. So anywhere it says he or he, it generally means anyone. Which is interesting because I did not know that that was a general rule. Okay, so we've established the category of Devarim Shebekedusha, holy things. Now let's go on to, and I think this is a lot of fun, what's a minyan? So, now we have the commentary in Megillah. From where are these matters? Which really means, if you go back to the previous Mishnah, what the question means in English is, from where do you derive the number 10? How did you get that? And now they go through, this is another exciting feature, a double Gezeira Shava, which you're going to see in a moment. So a Gezeira Shava is a Jewish interpretive principle whereby if you have a word that's used one way in a verse that you don't understand, you go look for another verse that has that word that you do understand, and then you read it back into the first. So, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said the name of Rabbi Yochanan. So we have a text from the book of Leviticus. I will be sanctified among the children of Israel. And he's saying, that act of sanctification requires 10. Now, how does it do that? So I have the verse printed in Hebrew. You will not defame God's name. You will sanctify it. Betoch, in the midst, in red, of Bnei Yisrael. I am God, and you will be holy. So the word betoch is among. How do you define that? So you go to another verse in the Torah, and this time it's in Numbers, And this is in the description of Korach, who's the rebel who tries to overturn Moses. So, if we look at that verse, it says, separate yourselves mitoch ha'edah, from the midst of the congregation. So, what we have, this is Gezerah Shava number one, is the word toch, in the middle of. So we've taken the first verse, which talks about holy things, and you have to be in the middle of a group, to now getting to the second verse about Korach, where again that word mitoch is used. And so it's referring to the group of Korach. But who is the group of Korach? So now we look at the second of the Gezerah Shavot, which is Gezerah Shavot, Ha'edah, right? We use this word a lot today. Edah means the congregation. An aid in Hebrew is a witness. So we take that verse in the midst of the congregation and we go to yet another verse which is talking about the spies. And there we find the same verse, that it was a congregation of evil. So we know there were 12 spies, and we know that two of them were Joshua and Caleb, so they're good guys. 12 minus 2 is 10. That's where we get 10 for a minion. Wow. It's a lot of work. Yes. Okay, there is a second way to get this, and I think there's a third, but I couldn't remember it, which is, if you look at Joseph and the 12 tribes, it's derived from there that the two good guys among the tribes, again, were Joseph and Benjamin, even though Joseph doesn't get a tribe. So out of the 12 brothers, two were good, the other 10 were evil, and they are also called an Edah in the Torah.
So in both those instances, the 10 is the 10 bad guys, rather than the 2 good guys.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah. So wouldn't you think it should be 2 people that you would need?
Well, yeah, but...
Yeah, I would think.
No, because you're defining a word.
But the 10, defined the action. So in the case of the spies, because 10 decided that we shouldn't, you know, go into Canaan...
But we did go.
No, we didn't. No, not the spies. Then. Right. Because the 10 decided we shouldn't go, that became
okay.
The decision of the
community.
This is just, it's about defining the word Edah. I wouldn't even go to English. And no, but that's it. Just happens to be a bad Edah, but it's still an Edah.
But in both cases, they're bad Edah.
Well, yeah.
Yes, but which is also interesting, in all Jewish camps, Edah is the term they use for their group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you do Edah is the...
Yep.
Edah was a more pop. Now, Kehillah really means the same thing, but everyone liked Edah in the old days. Or don't they say it was at Rosh Edah?
Correct.
The camps?
All the Jewish camps.
Ramah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just Ramah. It's all of them. It's all of them. Edah is your group name.
It's the word, yeah.
All right, so we've gone through all that work to establish a minion is 10. 10 what? That's the next question.
Right.
So we turn to Maimonides again. In the same tractate, which we've been looking at actually, it's all about prayer. And he says, what is implied by the term communal prayer? That means one person prays, leads, and everyone else listens, you know, says amen. And he goes on to add, this should not be done with fewer than 10 adult free males. Now, if you look at the Hebrew, right, he says, it's the last... 4 words. Me esrei gidolim. Esrei is 10. Gidolim means adults.
Age of majority.
Ubnei chorin, and they are free people, not slaves. Now, once again, philological interest. Some manuscripts say esrei anashim, which would really mean men. Some say gidolim, which means adults. So it's not clear whether
again, you have this issue that in Hebrew, the plural, if it's a mixed group,
right? That's a second argument you could make.
The male.
That's a second argument you could make for there. So, do women count as part of this group of 10. There are, not surprisingly, 3 schools of thought.
Only 3?
The main branches.
No, actually there's more. But the first school says Minyan are 10 individuals of equal maximal obligation. There's the word again. Therefore, women cannot constitute a Minyan, either together with men, or even if it's all women, for those rituals where they are not obligated or lack the maximal obligation of men. Maximal obligation probably means something like men are obligated 3 times a day, women are obligated 2 a day, or not at all. On the other hand, they may indeed participate in a minyan for the performance of those mitzvot, whether of biblical authority or rabbinic authority, where they share an equal obligation with men. Example, reading the Megillah. So women have an equal obligation to men of hearing the Megillah. Now, when you go from hearing to reading, that's a jump we won't talk about.
Isn't that more the issue of hearing a woman's voice rather than having...
No, that's a secondary consideration. It's the whole thing whether they're obligated. Now, it gets a little thornier, right? Because women are obligated to pray. We've established that. But not necessarily for public prayer, which is a different mitzvah in and of itself. So it's not clear here if it's a public situation that women are obligated. And public would really mean like in our normal Shabbat service would be considered public. Now, even with this school of thought, of course, what's the perennial women's issue is it modest? So the next consideration in that school would be, well, even if they are obligated, is it modest for women, let's say, to get up on a bima and be seen by men? Because we know that that obviously invites bad thoughts on the part of men. So this is school number one, which is yes, sometimes. School number two categorically rejects the inclusion of any kind of minyan whatsoever. What is the basis for this? The basis for this is the bottom text, the Bavli here, in Brachot. And it's part of, again, this discussion about minyans. So there's a come in here, Tashma, which I think always means a practical example. They're talking about forming a zimun. So a zimun is the minimum number of people you can have to say Birkat Hamazon. Right? You don't need a minyan for Birkat Hamazon, you need 3 people. And the text says, women form a zimun for themselves. So 3 women. Having a zimun means not saying Birkat Hamazon. Everyone has the obligation to do a blessing on food. It's the part in the front where we always call up a kid to lead. Rabotai Nevarech, da-da-da-da. That's zimun. So when you have 3 women, they can do that. And 3 slaves can do that. But you can't mix them up. So women, slaves, and minors, once again, they cannot form a mixed zimun. Now, this is the stinker here. 100 women considered the equivalent of 2 men. So what they're saying is, if you've got 100 women, if you've got 1,000 women and 2 men, they still do not form a zimun. Which means, if you do the math, The Gemara is saying that a woman cannot participate with a man for zimun under any circumstances. Right? There's no level that will make that work. So that's when you go back to school number 2. They're using this as an example that 100 women are like 2 men. Therefore, women can never really be mixed with men to form a minyan or a zimun.
I guess it's... Does it go back to the modesty issue? But, you know, men praying with women. I mean, in order to be in the minyan, men have to pray with women, which is something that, you know, in the same, you know, like without a mechitza. I mean, so...
No. So the mechitza is okay. I actually looked this up. So if you feel that women are part of the minyan, the fact that there's a separation does not matter.
Oh,
because they're all in the same place.
Okay, so they're praying together, they're just separated.
Yeah.
Yes, very good.
Because they can all hear.
Okay. And the last school of thought, that it is necessary to differentiate between two types of minyan. Normally the sages require 10 male adults as a prerequisite for the performance of particular rituals, generally communal rituals. However, in certain cases, the minyan is not intrinsic to the performance of the mitzvah, for the obligation is essential to the individual. Rather, the minyan is only needed to give publicity to the performance, and in such a case, women are counted even if their obligation is not equivalent to the man's obligation. Example, once again, the Megillah reading. So, if you go and say, what's the purpose of the Megillah reading, forget about obligations now to hear the Megillah, you have an obligation to publicize this miracle of Purim. And if that's your mitzvah, then men and women are equally equivalent in that mitzvah, so they can participate together to do that. Other examples would be having a bris, a circumcision, or, relevant to us, a menorah lighting. Once again, it's publicizing the miracle, so women are as obligated as men in that sense, and they can do that. So those are the three schools of thought with minyan, and on top of all of this, there's another like second level consideration of women can form a minyan, but does it have to be composed of women only, or can it be mixed? And there are many schools of thought on that, probably most not very friendly towards women. Okay, so that's that. Last topic here is the Shliach Tzibur. So, Shliach Tzibur literally means the agent for the community. And Shliach Tzibur in our day has basically come to mean the Chazan. Right, so there's kind of a legal fiction going on that when the Chazan stands up on the Bima, he prays on our behalf. So, he is our agent. We have a mitzvah to pray. The mitzvah is discharged by the Shliach Tzibur. So we go back to the Mishnah on Rosh Hashanah, actually, which says, a deaf mute, a lunatic, and a minor cannot cause others to fulfill their religious obligation. So the context here is blowing shofar. That's what they're talking about in the Mishnah. And they are saying that since these three categories of people, a deaf mute, because he can't hear the shofar, and right, the mitzvah is to hear the shofar, and a lunatic, which is someone who doesn't understand what they're doing, and finally a minor, who has not the obligation to hear the shofar, cannot blow shofar because they're not obligated themselves to hear shofar. Therefore, they can't do it on my behalf, on your behalf. Okay? This is true in all cases, and to finish that. So the general principle is, one who is not personally obligated in the matter of performing a mitzvah, cannot perform it on behalf of others. So we go all the way back again. If a woman is obligated in, let's say, tefillah, then she can discharge that obligation on the behalf of men. But if she is not obligated in that tefillah, then she can't do it. So the answer to can a woman lead services or do those kind of things all depends on whether you accept the first issue or not about obligation. You're smiling.
Where did the conservative movement hang their hat to, you know, allow women to...
That is an excellent question, because you're leading me into the last part. So just to summarize this, I'll get to that in a second. If a woman is obligated in matters of prayer, like Amida, saying the Baruch Hu, repeating the Shemona Esrei, saying Kaddish, then she can lead davening. Now, One objection you can make with this, going all the way back to the beginning, is the Shema, right? Because Brachot, the Mishnah Brachot we just read, exempts women from saying the Shema. But now the argument says is, well, we don't say the Shema anymore like they used to say it with that call and answer thing. So therefore, women are obligated to recite the Shema. So it doesn't matter. And the Shema doesn't require a minyan anyway. You can say it on your own. Okay, so now we get to the last part, which is the mysterious Joel Roth. So Joel Roth is probably the leading, maybe he's on out now, but the leading halakhic authority of the conservative movement. And in 1986, when the conservative movement had the big discussion about ordaining women as rabbis, Joel Roth wrote a book about this. And he came up with no good answer to the question of obligation. So, just to give you this, there's three halakhic, general halakhic solutions about women's issues. And every one of them has a problem. So, number one, we say, women have no obligation. Right? This is the traditional, orthodox, positive, time-bound commandment rule. So women don't have that obligation, and therefore they cannot lead for others who don't have that, who have the obligation. That's one possibility. Possibility two is for women to be declared obligated. So the conservative movement, now I'm going to talk movement only, can rule, as of today, women now share the same obligations as men do. The problem with this is, if the women don't want this obligation, they are now as equally lousy sinners as men already are.
That's okay.
Well, you're putting a lot of people into a lot of sin. I'm just saying, it's a solution.
We don't believe,
but not every woman would want to have this solution. And the third way to do this is to have women declare themselves obligated, self-obliged. What is the problem with this? The problem is, if we're in a room and we want to have, say, the Amidah, you have to walk around and ask each woman, do you self-obligate? And that's considered embarrassing. Not everyone wants to get up and say yes, no in the crowded group. So that's not a great answer either. And that's where we stand today. I would say the conservative movement generally has decided that all women are obligated.
Yeah.
So they're all equal finks for not getting up at 6:30 and going to minyan.
Was it last year or the year before they came out with some response that said, because we're egalitarian, that means the obligations go with counting in a minyan?
Right, which is problematic, because this is now our fifth or sixth session on women's things, and Judy and I went to hear Joel Roth 20 years ago talk on this issue, and he said, one thing you have to know, they're all individual issues, counting in a minyan, saying the Shema, doing a circumcision, blah, blah, blah. So for the conservative movement to come out with a blanket obligation, you know, could be problematic, because there might be sub-issues that don't fall under this category.
Yeah, well, it was like anything else they published, they say, but, you know, your local rabbi may vary.
Right. Your mileage may vary on this.
Everything they do, it's, this is what it is, but if your rabbi says it's not.
Well, no, usually it's not this is what it is. It's, here's three different possible ways to do it, your rabbi will pick.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So. That is it.